have our third case for today, 99-1128 CR, State v. Colleen Hansen, Pamela Pepper, representing Colleen Hansen, Gregory M. Posner Weber, representing the state. Ms. Pepper, you may proceed.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Pamela Pepper. I represent the petitioner, the appellant in this case, Colleen Hansen. As the court is aware from the briefs, this issue involves an interpretation of 961.45 of the Narcotics Code of the state of Wisconsin and whether or not that statute is a bar to subsequent actions on behalf of the state which involve the same conduct or course of conduct as prosecutions that have already occurred in other sovereigns, in this particular case, in the federal court. As you're also aware, it's the appellant's position that, in fact, that statute does operate as a bar to prosecution, not just under double jeopardy principles, in other words, not just as a restatement of Blockberger versus the United States, but also taking one step further and also barring subsequent prosecutions that are based on conduct, the same course or set of conduct. The first portion of our argument is based on looking at the face of the statute itself. I'd like to begin by noting, Your Honors, that I believe the state has indicated that it feels that the statute is frankly clear on its face. I feel the statute's clear on its face as well. However, the clarity of that statute, I think, is different to me than it is to the state.
Counsel, do you think you're both reasonable minds?
I like to hope we're both reasonable. Knowing both of us, I think we are. However, acknowledging that reasonable minds can differ, in this particular instance, I don't think it is so obvious and so clear that the language of the statute is simply nothing more than a restatement of the Blockberger doctrine. The statute starts out, as you're aware, by saying, if a violation of this chapter, and then it goes on to say it's based on the same act as one that has already been prosecuted. The state's position is that violation of this chapter requires identity of law with the violation in the other sovereign.
Counsel, when you say it's the position of the state is that it's another Blockberger, am I hearing you correctly that you're in essence saying that the state's position is that this is simply a reiteration of double jeopardy principles?
To be clear, Judge, I think that's part of the state's position. I think the other part of it is that the state believes that this is a bar to the dual sovereignty doctrine.
Okay. And it's what?
A bar to the dual sovereignty doctrine, which is part of the double jeopardy doctrine.
Does that make sense? It's my understanding, although I've heard it debated, that even if the elements were precisely the same, you could have both a state and federal conviction.
Correct, Judge. That's the dual sovereignty doctrine, as of course you know.
And so this is saying, as far as the state of Wisconsin is going, we are waiving our right.
And that is what the state's position is, Judge, that that's as far as it goes.
And then the position is that to determine whether they are the same conviction, same crime for which we would waive our sovereignty.
Right.
The state wants to apply the Blockberger test.
That is my understanding.
What is the Blockberger test that the state uses? Does it just cover elements or does it also cover conduct?
I believe it covers both, Judge. Identity in law, which is through the elements, and identity in fact, which is through the conduct, which is the course of conduct, I would assume. So that is my understanding of what the state's argument is, Judge. We, however, believe that it goes farther than that, that this particular statute goes farther than that. As you're all aware from our briefs, there is precious little, if any, legislative history on either side, to fall on either side of this argument. It appears that the Wisconsin legislature adopted the Uniform Controlled Substances Act as a whole with very little, if any, debate. So we don't have much to look at in terms of legislative history. Therefore, we're left to determine the meaning of the statute by looking at the face of the statute, as well as, I believe, the circumstances surrounding the statute at the time that it was passed. The Uniform Controlled Substances Act was passed in 1970-71, and Wisconsin adopted it almost immediately after it was passed. It's interesting to note, I think, that shortly thereafter, there was a spate of decisions coming out of a variety of state courts that interpreted this statute in the way that Appellant Hansen now encourages this court to interpret it. I've cited some of those states in my brief, particularly the New York cases that you're familiar with from the brief. There are also a number of other states, however, that I didn't cite because their statutes might vary in one way or another in language from ours, and so I didn't think they were directly apropos. The New York statute, in fact, is almost identical to ours. But in fact, in the 1970s, shortly after the Uniform Narcotics Act was passed and a number of states adopted it, Alabama in 1979 issued an opinion which indicated that they interpreted their statute in the way that I'm encouraging the court to do. Arizona, Arkansas, California, Georgia, Illinois, Indiana, Montana, Pennsylvania, and South Dakota all have decisions which indicate that their statutes, while slightly different in some respects from ours, were intended to prohibit successive prosecutions for the same course of conduct, even if there was no identity of law, even if the elements were not the same.
Ms. Pepper, are most of those statutes similar to the statute from the state of New York, where the additional language about criminal transaction has been added?
Some of them are, Judge. Some of them go even further and frankly lay out very explicitly that if it's the same course of conduct, it doesn't make a difference whether there's identity in law. Those, I thought, were so different from our statute that they were not applicable.
Why shouldn't we look to the New Jersey cases, since that statute seems to be similar to ours, and those cases, as I understand them, would be contrary to your position?
I believe they are, Judge. You are correct. However, again, I think those cases, the reasoning in those cases, fails to take into account some of the logic that supports the interpretation that New York, for example, has adopted and some of the other states that I have referred to have adopted. I think it fails to take into account the New Jersey decisions, fails to take into account the efficiency arguments. They fail to take into account comedy arguments. They also fail to take into account what I think was prevailing case law at the time. We've referred a great deal in our briefs to the Blockberger decision and to the Blockberger doctrine. However, as we know, Blockberger is not the only test in determining double jeopardy.
But it is the test that has been used primarily in the state of Wisconsin, the Blockberger test. In fact,
that is correct, Judge.
Yes, since I've been out of court 9 years, I think it's been used against it.
And doesn't the Blockberger test look at the elements of the crime as opposed to any underlying conduct?
I believe it looks at both, Judge. It's primarily the elements. It requires identity of law, which is the elements.
When we apply the Blockberger test, don't we use it's the same elements test?
We do. I think for the most part it's almost always assumed that the conduct is the same.
I mean, for instance, in the case of State versus Vassos that we decided, a couple of years ago, in discussing the Blockberger test, we indicated the Blockberger test, same elements test.
Exactly. And
that's citing a number of other cases. That's what you compare the elements, right?
That's what we refer to it as. That's absolutely correct, Judge. And I realize that is, in fact, the test that's been used by this court, but that, I think, further points up Appellant Hansen's position, which is the Blockberger test has been entrenched in our judicial philosophy since 1932. It seems a little bit odd to interpret 961.45 as being a restatement of Blockberger. To interpret the statute in that way in some ways denudes it and renders it superfluous, somewhat obsolete.
The state says then, wait a minute now, if, as you say, it's since 1932 and then you had the petty case in 95 and the statute was there, they've made no attempt to change the statute and they are aware of what the court has done in petty and that
I mean, that's just the argument of the state. How do you answer that?
I think the argument applies equally, Judge, to the passage of the Uniform Narcotics Act or the Uniform Controlled Substances Act. Blockburger was there when the Uniform Controlled Substances Act was created and adopted.
Well, Penny mentioned that. Penny mentioned that in footnote about since the primary purpose of the Controlled Substance Narcotic Act as a whole was to achieve uniformity and provide an interlocking trellis of drug laws, 96145 should bar, subsequent state prosecution only when the offenses are substantially the same. The point is that if you use the block, if the state says Blockburger has been what has been used, and there is no reason to assume that the legislature wasn't aware of that.
But in the same vein, Judge, if Blockburger has been used and the creators of the Uniform Controlled Substances Act were aware of that, then why would they codify it? If they meant to codify it, they could have explicitly done so. They could have simply said, same offenses, which is the Blockburger language that everyone
well,
uses.
Well, we've codified Blockburger, right? I mean, let me be more
clear. Sorry, Judge.
I'm sorry. We have codified Blockburger in 93966, and we have codified Blockburger in 93971. In fact, if there's any doubt about it, that's what we said in Vasos. Subsection 1 of 93966, like RISC Stats 93971, codifies the Blockburger same elements test. And then it cites State versus Aceto also. So we codified it. That language that I'm referring to is the in essence, the 93966 language that is all of sub 1. A crime which does not require proof of any fact in addition to those which must be proved for the same crime. That's the entirety of sub 1. And we've codified it in 93971, looking at the towards the end of that, when we say does not require proof of a fact for conviction which the other does not require. So if you want to codify it, we know how to do it. We've done it in the very statute. 93966 is the statute, and right after that, that's 93971 interposed with 93970. So we've done it.
Right, and I'm not saying, Judge, that there's a prohibition on codifying a constitutional protection. However, just looking at the language of those two statutes, what it also shows is the Wisconsin legislature knows exactly how to codify double jeopardy if that's what they're choosing to do.
So shouldn't that be your argument? They know how to do it if they want to do it?
I guess that's what I'm trying to say inartfully, Judge, is that that's exactly the case. They know how to say it if they want to say it. That's not what they said. It's not what the creator of the Uniform Controlled Substances Act said. And they had the equipment there to say it if they had wanted to. They didn't. This language doesn't expressly refer to an element of one that doesn't have to be proven for an element of the other, or similar language. And therefore, that goes back to my original point that I don't think it's as clear as the state indicates that it is.
I think you did a very good job in your brief of trying to get out from under the footnote in Petty.
It was a
that
petty
was a
footnote.
Good
try. No, it was a long
It was
footnote.
Not a petty footnote.
But if you really look at what's being said here, and I agree you did a good reading because you prefer not to force the court to withdraw language from a 1996 opinion. But the language in Note 13 says, okay, that Petty argues that it's not Blockburger. However, defendant doesn't offer authority, which seemingly contradicts. There's no support in the legislative history, that's what the state said, to substantiate the claim of that intent. And then there's a conclusion. Rather, the statutory language tracks Blockberger as it expressly requires an identity of law between the two statutes, as well as an identity of fact, the same act. Moreover, the fact the primary purpose is to achieve uniformity while providing the interlocking trellis of drug laws, that's very picturesque.
Yes.
Among the state and federal jurisdictions strongly supports the state assertions that 16145 bars a subsequent state prosecution only where the offenses are substantially the same in fact and law. And then there's a citation to the handbook, and that the defendant failed to provide any authority to bolster an alternative, and we do not agree with this novel reading of the statute in question, period. How do you get around that? I mean, the court has made a decision. Maybe it's wrong, but there's a decision, and it seems to be on all fours. You can argue that it's dicta, because that's not what the case was about, but then the rules of our cases say if the court reaches out and decides a question, it's not dicta. It's a holding of the court. So you're really asking us to, it seems to me, overrule footnote 13.
To be totally straightforward with you, Judge, yes,
that's
I think that's
idea.
Exactly what I'm asking you to do. Not to imply that I wouldn't be straightforward with you. I think more appropriately, I suppose, I'm asking you to reconsider footnote 13. Because while I agree with the first two premises of the footnote, I agree that in that case there was no authority provided to support the position. And number two, I agree that there's no legislative history to support their position because, as we've noted here, there's no legislative history, period. The only portion that I don't agree with is that it therefore follows that the language of the statute tracks Blockberger. That is the part that I'm not entirely sure can be gleaned from the absence of authority or the absence the absence of other decisions.
I did not go back into the history of Petty. Was that question ever briefed? Did you look at the briefs?
I did not look at the briefs, Judge, although I spoke with the attorney who represented the public defender's office. She indicated that it had, to some degree, been briefed, yes.
Well,
but the
it
court
says here that the state, as the state recognizes, and it goes on to say that they're really accepting the state's position that must have been set forth. Right. It was set forth at great length or at lesser length, that's not true. So it was briefed.
It was, Judge.
Can I just ask you, when you say you did the legislative history, I noticed that in footnote 13 is just a reference to the prefatory note in the handbook. But there are minutes of the annual meetings of the National Conference of Commissioners that depends on the law. Sometimes there's nothing in them that's helpful. But at other times, they discuss it on the floor of the commissioner's meeting at great length and vote on particular language after. So how far back in the legislative history did you look?
Well, what I ended up doing was contacting the Conference of Commissioners. And to be candid, they were not particularly helpful. they indicated that they didn't have anything. Well, first of all, they didn't call me back several times. And then when they did, they indicated that it was pretty far back. I ended up not being able to get from them whether that information existed.
Could I ask a follow-up question?
Yes, sir.
There's no commentary with respect to Section 418 of the Uniform Act from, what was it, 1990?
Right.
Was there any commentary in the 1971 Act?
Not that I have, Judge. Not that I'm aware of. I don't believe there was.
Now, maybe I'm not understanding this, but was there a statute that preceded our adoption of the Uniform Act in 1971 that's relevant to this?
Yeah, I believe I've cited a judge, and I believe it was Section 405, if I'm recalling accurately.
405 was the Uniform Act of 1971.
Okay, then I'm not...
Was there a Wisconsin statute?
I believe there was, Judge, and if you can give me just a moment, I can check back through the brief. I don't see it cited in my brief, Judge, although, and I'd have to admit to you that I don't know the authority, but I recall having come across in my research that there was a predecessor statute. But unfortunately, I'm not prepared to give you the cite for it at this time. I also think, referring back, however, to a question that... an issue that Justice Wilcox raised, this issue of the interlocking trellis of state and federal drug laws and the issue of uniformity. It is clear that that was the main purpose of the Uniform Controlled Substances Act. However, I'm not sure that the petty reading of 961.45 accomplishes that. I think more and more, at least in my experience in the last 4 or 5 years, it has become more and more common to have joint federal and state drug task forces. This has always been the case, but funding has become available more recently and there have been more of them created. As a prosecutor, when I began prosecuting some 10 or 11 years ago, what we would do was pick up the phone and call over to the state and say, do you guys want this case or should we take it? I think that the incidences of the type of situation that we see here are rising. And that is situations where someone becomes susceptible to and, in fact, is prosecuted both in federal and in state court on drug offenses. I think if the goal of uniformity is to make certain that the statutes function relatively the same way in each state, then we have to look to some degree what other states have done and are doing. And it seems that after the adoption of the Uniform Controlled Substances Act, most states adopted a position, statutorily or through case law, that indicated that they would not proceed on a matter based on the same facts, even if there was no identity in law, if another sovereign, specifically the United States, had already proceeded on it. In that same way, from a fairness standpoint, from an equity standpoint, I brought up the question of the Pettit policy in the United States. Now, I understand, as the state has pointed out, that the Uniform Controlled Substances Act is not based on the Pettit policy. I don't believe that there's any direct connection between the two in terms of how one was decided or created. However, I think it's ironic to note that in this particular case, had Colleen Hansen been prosecuted in state court first, had that occurred first, the federal government would not have prosecuted her because of their voluntary Pettit policy.
Is that written anywhere?
It is, the Pettit policy. It's in the United States Attorney's Handbook, and it also arises out of United States versus Pettit, which is the case that gave it its name. And I believe I've cited both in the brief,
okay.
Judge.
Pettit, not to be confused with Petty.
Correct.
Okay.
Counsel, just going back to this, if the legislature has adopted this, and then you have the Petty case, as Chief mentioned, mandated, published in 96. If they would have disagreed with this, they'd have 5 years, literally, to change the law.
That's correct.
And they haven't acted. And that's, if they thought that this had disagreed with their legislative policy. So the Legislative Drafting Bureau, the revisor statutes, or whatever it was, went over this and apparently took the position that this was in line with the 961.45.
And I certainly think that's one way to look at it, Judge. However, I think it returns us back to a position where we do what we have been doing for a little while, and that's trying to speculate on what the legislature intended. As we've noted, they knew how to write a statute codifying double jeopardy and didn't do it, but we don't have the legislative history to tell us why they didn't. One would think they would have. Now, in 1996, when Petty's decided, they could have rewritten the statute. They haven't done it, and we're left to speculate as to why they haven't done that.
But there is an assumption that when you have a case, and if they disagree with the case and there is a statute, then that didn't kick in either. So disregarding the earlier assumption that there wasn't an appropriate legislative history, at least this is more, at least seems to be more affirmative of the fact that that this court in Petty correctly gauged what the legislature had said in 961.45. At least that's the way the argument is.
I see that argument, Judge. On the other hand, I also see, and those of you who have sat in the legislature know better than I, that there are any number of reasons why they may not have acted on it that may not have anything to do with putting a rubber stamp on the Petty decision. It seems interesting to me to note that in all this time, this statute appears only to have been raised in one decision that reached your court. I think that's a little bit strange considering the length of time that the statute's been around now, a little over 30 years. I also realized when I started working on this opinion myself and started writing my brief that virtually every defense attorney that I talked to had never heard of this statute and didn't realize it was there. Now, I suppose that could be general incompetence. On the other hand, what it could mean is that this matter simply hasn't risen to the level of catching legislative attention, particularly with their full docket, or their full caseload. So I'm not certain that it's appropriate to automatically assume that that's why they have not acted. In conclusion, because I see I've run out of time here, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my remarks for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Assistant Attorney General Gregory M. Posner-Weber.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice, members of the court. I have a really bad cold, so I apologize in advance if I lose my voice. The state is asking this court to hold that the term same act under section 961.45 is defined by the elements of the crimes involved. Ordinarily, the double jeopardy clause of the Fifth Amendment prevents the state from prosecuting a defendant twice for the same offense. But successive federal and state prosecutions involve two different sovereigns. The United States Supreme Court has held in a line of cases that each sovereign is entitled to enforce its own laws and cannot be barred by a previous prosecution in another jurisdiction. Now, counsel has pointed out that a number of states have enacted statutory limitations on their own authority to conduct a subsequent prosecution, and Section 961.45 is such a statute. It applies double jeopardy principles to limit the dual sovereignty doctrine in Wisconsin. It creates, in essence, a statutory form of double jeopardy for purposes of prosecutions under the Controlled Substances Law. This has been a very, very frustrating case for me to prepare, to brief, and to prepare for argument. I have never had a situation where I was not able to glean some essence of legislative intent from the history of the statute or from case law or from extrinsic materials. It's just been very, very difficult to identify with any kind of precision or any kind of confidence what the legislature intended when it passed 961.45 and what it intended in subsequent legislative activity. The only real fuel we have as advocates is this court's decision in Petty. And this court held that in the absence of any legislative history to the contrary, the primary interpretive tool for 961.45 should be Blockberger versus United States. Our position is, in essence, the position that this court took in the footnote in Petty. 961.45 should be interpreted as requiring identity of fact and law between the Wisconsin charge and the federal charge, or that of another state, another sovereign, in order to bar a state prosecution in Wisconsin. And our position is that there is no identity of fact and law in this case. The case law is very clear from the United States Supreme Court, United States versus Felix, that a substantive crime and a conspiracy to commit that crime are not the same offense for double jeopardy purposes. Under Blockberger, a conspiracy to distribute cocaine under federal law and possession of cocaine with intent to deliver under Wisconsin law simply can't be considered the same act. Justice Wilcox touched on a point that I think is important when we try and gauge the mind of the legislature or the intent of the legislature with respect to the statutory scheme. And that is that Petty's been on the books since May 31st of 1996, and the legislature has not seen fit to take any action to amend 961.45 to change the scope of that statute in light of this court's analysis in Petty. There are all sorts of wonderful abstract maxims that we use to try and divine legislative intent. And the only one that even seems remotely appropriate here is the law, the principle of law that holds that if the legislature doesn't act in the face of a judicial interpretation, it can be viewed as a confirmation of that interpretation. The state legislature made substantive changes when it changed the numbering sequence of the Controlled Substances Act from Chapter 161 to Chapter 961. That legislative activity took place in 1995, WIS Act 448. Now, the timing is crucial here, and in fairness and candor to the court, 1995 WIS Act 448 was enacted June 24th of 1996. It was published July 8th of 1996. Petty was decided at the end of May 1996. So that first legislative change in the statute occurred within a month of this court's decision in Petty, and I am not real comfortable saying they could have acted within that 3 to 4 week period of time but didn't. Therefore, we have to assume, you know, that the legislature accepted the Petty analysis. But 5 years have passed. We're in 2001 now, and the legislature has not acted.
Mr. Pizer-Weber.
Sir.
Assume that 961.45 is not in existence and never has been. Would you still be able to prosecute?
We'd apply 939.71, which seems to be the statute on point. We'd do a Blockberger analysis.
Well, that's the point of my question. What use does 961.45 have if what it apparently allows in your eyes can be accomplished anyway?
And that's a point that the Court of Appeals raised in the certification as well, this whole notion that the statute is superfluous. It's not superfluous, because 939.71 doesn't specifically reach the dual sovereignty doctrine. It's a statute of general application insofar as subsequent prosecutions are concerned. Secondly, it ignores the fact that the legislature could reasonably codify by statute an existing constitutional protection and make it an element of state statutory law with respect to the dual sovereignty doctrine and its applicability to drug cases. It's not superfluous, because the legislature certainly has the authority and can find justification to create that statute in the context of the controlled substances law. If Blockberger went out the window tomorrow, if we went back to Corbin versus Grady, the level of state statutory protection insofar as the dual sovereignty doctrine is concerned would remain the same. I mean, the legislature has enacted this statute that goes directly to dual sovereignty and double jeopardy protections in the context of drug cases. It's not superfluous.
If I could just follow up on that, in a sense, it's superfluous only if the Blockberger test is not met. It's clearly not superfluous if the Blockberger test for identity of fact and law is met, because then, under the dual sovereignty doctrine, there can be dual prosecutions, but for the statute. So it's superfluous in one situation, but not the other.
Counsel, I want to draw your attention to what you just, the statute you're just referring to, as was Justice Sykes, that is 93971. Now, let me say by way of preface, in the case before us, we're dealing with 96145 and the interpretation of that statute. And the word that we are interpreting is act. And it's your position that act means the crime or the elements, as I understand it. And that your opposing counsel says, no, act means conduct, as I understand the argument. So it is. So I'm saying, what does act mean? Does it mean the crime hyphen elements of the crime, or does it mean conduct? Now, and so what did the legislature mean when it wrote and used the word act? And I look at 93971 that we were just discussing. And there, the legislature uses the word act to mean conduct. If an act forms the basis for a crime, do you agree that the word act means conduct there? Almost by the juxtaposition of using the word crime four words later. Act does not mean crime. I mean, act means conduct here. Is that correct?
You could substitute the word conduct for act there, certainly.
And then 939.71 goes on to codify the Blockberger test.
Yes.
So when in 939.71, when the legislature uses the word act, it means conduct. Same page. Do you have that page in front of you?
Statutes.
Of the statutes, yes. And I'm looking at 939.65. On the same page, right. As 93971. And I see 93965 actually as quite similar to the statute that is the essence of this case, to 96145. 96145 deals with what do you do with prosecutions when you have this, you know, dual sovereignty. 93965 is similar, you know, prosecutions under one or more section permitted. And I look at the word act there. In 93965, and it appears to me that the word act means conduct. The legislature intended the word act to mean conduct. Would you agree?
Again, I think you could substitute conduct for act there in the same way that you could for 93971.
And just like 93971, about four words later, they use the word crime. So they know how to say crime, hyphen elements, if they want to. And they know how to say act. And when they say act, they mean, in this instance, in a similar statute, conduct. When they want the Blockberger test, they know how to codify the Blockberger test. They did that on the same page, 93966 and 93971. So why should we, the statute that is the basis of this case, 96145, say, oh, here, when the legislature writes act, they don't mean conduct, they mean crime. And not only do they not mean conduct, by writing act, they mean to codify Blockberger. Although in other statutes, when they want to codify Blockberger, they do it by the words, which does not require proof of any fact in addition to those which must be proved for the crime charge. So I think act means conduct.
Respond.
A, Blockberger uses the term Act 284 U.S. at 304.
And I'm talking about what's the legislative intent?
Well, I wish I knew.
My point is, what did the legislature mean by Act?
If
they use it in other statutes that are similar, they mean conduct.
Justice Bradley, I feel much more confident with your bottom line in this if the language of 96145 hadn't been adopted as part of a model statute with little, if any, discussion by the legislature, by way of recorded discussion, something we can point to. The uniform laws certainly are coming out of a case law model that's based on Blockberger. Blockberger and the principles in Blockberger have controlled double jeopardy law, except for that nasty Corbin period of time since the 1930s. Blockberger itself speaks in terms of acts. I don't feel comfortable. I don't feel comfortable ascribing legislative intent in 96145 based on language from other statutes not enacted at the same time, not enacted as part of the same legislative package. I also am not comfortable with implying or inferring that act in one context means the same thing as act in another, when the legislature has been silent since 1996 on this.
They've been busy with the budgets or something.
And truth in sentencing.
If I could jump in for a moment. The Uniform Controlled Substances Act was passed in the 1995 session.
Yes.
When the then speaker created a special committee for the sole purpose of passing the Uniform Act. So, I have no idea what this means, but I am quite confident in my own mind that the intent is not going to be found in other extraneous sections of the Wisconsin statutes. It's going to be found in the history of the uniform law. The uniform law going back to 1971. Now, I'm interested in... I thought I inferred from your brief that there was a provision that preceded the 1971 law. Is that right, or am I wrong?
There has been, and I was looking in my brief too, and I'm not finding the spot that I thought was there. But I believe that there were double jeopardy statutes, perhaps similar to 93971, that were in place prior to 1971 when they adopted the Uniform Act. I don't think that there was...
You think it was a Wisconsin statute, not a preceding uniform statute?
Right, Wisconsin statute.
Okay.
Yeah, the actual tracking of the legislative history of 96145 is at page 8 of our brief. And I'm understanding your question to be, was there a double jeopardy provision in place, perhaps a general double jeopardy provision before 1971? And my answer is a qualified yes, but I would suspect that it probably was part of the 1955 revisions. And I don't have my 1955 materials here, but I am reasonably sure that if we go into that, we're going to find an analog to current 93971.
But my immediate reaction to this is, first, I would like to know whether there was commentary in the 1971 Act. I wasn't able to locate that, but I suspect it's over in the law library.
But did you check the Uniform Law Act volumes, the series that has all the acts in it?
There's no commentary on the current Section 418 of the Act. That is...
There's also no commentary on the original 405. There is a prefatory note that talks in general terms about purposes of the Act, nothing specific to the double jeopardy provisions. I didn't check for session notes.
Yeah, you have to do the minutes. I did that years ago, and in one instance I found a great deal, and in another instance nothing.
I'm reasonably certain that
to talk about.
One other inference that might be drawn is that New York is a pretty shrewd state, very interested in this subject. When they added additional language about transaction to their adoption of uniform law, I wonder if they did that at the time they passed the law or whether they did it subsequently and why they did it. Because if they added additional language, presumably they did for a reason.
I didn't research the legislative history beyond the discussions of it in Abamonte and the other New York cases.
Well, I have a different attack. And it's on, after all, we have to really look at context. And I can understand your concern about dealing with a Uniform Act, which theoretically shouldn't change too much, either in interpretation or in language, because you want uniformity. I'm not sure that uniformity is an important issue here, but nevertheless. Look at 939.72. In 939.72, this legislature, our legislature, has gone farther than Blockberger. It says Blockberger isn't good enough to really be fair, and though we might get something under Blockberger, but we don't want double prosecutions, right? We don't want, I shouldn't say double prosecutions, we don't want double convictions, right? And 939.72 subsection 2 says you shouldn't have a double conviction for a conspiracy under 939.31 and party to a crime of the object of the conspiracy 939.05. Now, is that what you have here? Forget about state and federal. Would it fall under 2?
No. 939.72 does not apply. She wasn't charged as party to the crime.
But it doesn't. Pardon me?
She was not charged as a party to the crime.
Well, party to a crime in this state means the actual doer, a conspirator, and an aider and abettor. So when you say party to a crime, you're including everything.
You are, but you can charge specifically as a party to the crime, and then at the time of trial, you make a case as to whether they're a principal or whether they're an accomplice.
I know, but
she was charged straight up with possession with intent
okay,
to deliver.
Okay, but it's for the conspiracy and for the object of the conspiracy.
Sure,
and
sure, but only...
Then your position here is what party of crime means, but there's another interpretation for that. And the point of sub 2 was to avoid this kind of double whammy. Because if you're right, then in this state, you could charge him with conspiracy and charge him as a principal to the objective of the crime and get two convictions.
You couldn't. You could not.
That's
if your theory was accomplice liability on the underlying substantive offense, you could not charge under 939.05 and sustain a separate charge for the inchoate crime of conspiracy.
But you can as principal, you're saying, and the conspiracy.
Yes.
But that may be debatable.
And even in the context that you are suggesting, I think ultimately it would have to be a situation where the state, I don't think it precludes, yeah, it doesn't preclude the charging. Have to elect at some point.
I know that. I understand that. Okay. But we're talking about convictions here. So we're out of that game.
Okay.
We're into convictions. All right. So you don't accept that as a contextual interpretation?
No, Chief, I don't.
Would you if it was a party, an accomplice, or an aider or a better?
I wouldn't, because 939.72 doesn't purport to address dual sovereignty issues.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that.
So you're looking just at the underlying principle of it?
The underlying principle here is that the state applies broader than a Blockberger test in at least three examples under 939.72. And it seemed to me it was arguable and that the case we have here with two sovereigns comes under 2, and you could therefore argue that in this state, at least the legislature has expressed that intent. Definitely not related to two sovereigns, but the intent is there. You don't think it's worth very much. It's okay. I'm not offended.
Thank you, Chief. I appreciate that. I'd have to think about how much we could infer from the from a statute that controls prosecutions by one sovereign. I don't think there's any. Well, maybe there is a dispute as to whether the statute would act as a bar under the dual sovereignty doctrine, would act as a separate bar. I don't think it does. Even if it were to do that, we don't have a conspiracy theory of liability in this case. As part of my very frustrating quest to try and come up with some sort of legislative history or statutory interpretation to help this court, I spent some time looking at the language in 961.001. The legislature giveth and taketh away in this statute. They don't give us much by way of legislative intent, but they include a declaration of intent as part of the statute. And in 961.001, sub 1M and sub 1R, the legislature stresses the detrimental effect of drug sales and trafficking on the people of this state and the public health and safety. If we're going to infer anything from the language of the chapter, I'm inclined to infer that the legislature's intent here was to preserve rather than withdraw the state's authority to enforce its own prohibitions against controlled substances violations. We prosecute, in essence, under a federalist system of government. We have multiple sovereigns, each possessing separate authority to prosecute, to vindicate and validate their own laws. By any objective standard, the primary responsibility for criminal prosecution in this country rests with the states. And in the absence of any legislative intent, clearly definable legislative intent, that the legislature intended this to serve as a positive, affirmative limitation on the state's authority to issue charges as they did here, I would ask this court to interpret the statute in a way that preserves the prosecutor's autonomy to issue charges, to vindicate and validate the state's laws against the use of controlled substances. I'd prefer to spend the rest of my time with questions.
Well, you're quite fortunate. Do you have a question, Justice?
I think, except to say that in footnote 13, I think we noted the lack or commented on the lack of legislative history, both federal and state, and that I think both counsel understand that.
There is actually one point before I sit down. This court ought to take the opportunity in the context of this case to adopt the line of analysis that's set out in United States versus Felix about the distinctions between conspiracy and the substantive criminal offense. There's a real dearth of case law in Wisconsin on that point. The closest thing that this court has issued within the last few years is the
Moffitt
decision that came out December 19th, Becker's case. I would ask this court, in the context of its interpretation of 961.45, one of the steps that we take is to draw a real distinction between a conspiracy to commit the substantive drug offense and the substantive drug offense itself. This court should make it clear, consistent with Felix, that they're not the same.
Thank you, Mr. Posner-Weber. Before Ms. Pepper rises for the five-minute rebuttal, I would like to recognize a guest, Mr. Takasumi Hayano, who is with the Japanese Legal Reform Council and his translator. Konnichiwa. And we'd like to hear, after the case is concluded, something about what your council is doing on selection, perhaps considering election of judges, if I read the Japan Times, which would be quite shocking. All right. We have 5 minutes of Pamela Pepper.
Thank you, Judge. I feel absolutely no stress or burden at being a representative for a visitor from Japan at all whatsoever. No. Just briefly, Your Honors, with regard to Mr. Posner-Weber's last couple of statements, I don't believe that interpretation of 961.45 in the way that is urged by Appellant Hansen would in fact detract from the state's authority to prosecute as it sees fit. First of all, the state of Wisconsin, of course, was not forced to pass this statute, chose to. But second of all, interpretation of this statute in the way that we urge doesn't in any way prevent the state from doing what I think state and federal governments have been doing for quite some time, and that is negotiating with each other to determine who is the best authority to proceed. That, I assume, would continue to happen regardless of this interpretation being adopted. So I don't think that that necessarily is a reason not to adopt the interpretation.
Counsel?
Yes, sir.
Just one question about conspiracy and then the intent to deliver. In fact, we have different elements. So here, I mean, in this case, on federal conspiracy, your intent to deliver, as opposing counsel observed, clearly do not have the same. You know, we just have not totally, but several different elements. How do you respond to that? I mean, you would not, at least in that case, they have the opportunity to prosecute both one federal, one state?
I totally agree, Judge. I don't think there's any question on anyone's part that the elements of those two offenses are different. It's been established federal jurisprudence for years. And I'm not saying that this particular statute doesn't recognize that. I think what this particular statute is saying is that even in cases in which the elements are different, we as a state choose not to prosecute when another sovereign has prosecuted already for other reasons. And I think that it's clear that that's an option that the state has. It's an option that other states have adopted, and in fact that the federal government has adopted through the Pettit policy. I think it's a reasonable option because of questions of comity and efficiency and quite frankly, fairness. If you refer back to the cases that both precede and come after Blockberger, cases like Brown versus Ohio, cases like United States versus Green, even Ash versus Swenson, which of course is a res judicata case or a collateral estoppel case and not necessarily not a double jeopardy case. But in each of those cases, the Supreme Court has reiterated over and over and over again its belief that the Double Jeopardy Clause is there to prevent a citizen from being, as they like to put it, run through the same gauntlet twice for what is basically the same offense. I think this is one of those cases where this statute, if interpreted in the way that Hansen urges this court to do, would avoid that kind of problem. And I'll close by just indicating to you a little bit, you're already aware of the facts in this case, but I think it bears repeating that Colleen Hansen, when she was arrested, was 26 years old. She had no prior criminal history. She was the only person out of the federal co-conspirators who was prosecuted in both state court and federal court. And the result of that was that she ended up between the state and federal sentences getting a longer sentence than the next most culpable co-defendant in federal court, who also happened to be her stepfather. I think that circumstance begs some degree of review in a situation where, because of the way things fell out, her situation was so strongly impacted by the dual prosecutions.
I have one final question, Ms. Pepper. There's been lots of discussion about the lack of legislative history for the statute and the lack of any guidance from the uniform laws materials and how that hampers our search for legislative intent here. And I guess I'd like you to address what's wrong with just looking at the language of the statute for the meaning of the statute. There's a novel sort of a proposition, and if we do that, we find that it says if a violation of this chapter is a violation of federal law or the law of another state, there's the identity and law component of Blackburger. A conviction or acquittal under federal law or the law of another state for the same act, there's the identity and fact part of Blackburger. Is there anything wrong with that reading?
May I continue, Judge? I've got a red light. First of all, I don't think there's anything wrong with looking at the plain meaning of the statute, Judge, and I would love to have been able to walk in here and say, I don't think there's any ambiguity. I think the statute's clear on its face. However, I would disagree with you about the way it's clear on its face. When it says a violation of this chapter, when 961.45 says a violation of this chapter, the petty footnote, and as you've just stated, both assume that what that means is an identical violation in law. In fact, I think it's important to note the context, because this is a Uniform Controlled Substances Act, as Mr. Posner-Weber indicated, I think there's another interpretation of that language itself. I think a violation of this chapter could be language that simply constricts the operation 961.45 to drug offenses and not to other offenses in the statutory scheme. That's my reading, in fact, of that language. So I like looking at the face of the statute, but I'm not sure it answers the question fully. Is there any other?
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Ms. Pepper. Thank you, Mr. Wooden-Posner. That concludes our hearing on this case today. We are in recess until, I think it's Tuesday, but I've forgotten the time. You can look it up if you're coming. Thank you.